This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. On the program today, what you missed while all those hearings were going on. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 22nd of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Hodgepodgey kind of week, economy-wise, to be honest with you, in between breaks in the hearings on Capitol Hill. But the economy waits for no one. So here we are. Catherine Rempel is at the Washington Post. Neela Richardson is with Edward Jones. They are both in New York City. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
Neela, let me start with you and two observations from this week. Number one, a report on consumer sentiment out this morning. It is up. Consumers are still feeling good in this economy. Indicator number two, the minutes from the most recent Federal Reserve meeting, in which everyone was in the loop that basically we're done with interest rate raises for a while, cuts for a while. Where are we?
We're in a good place, apparently, and that's the message that's coming out of the Fed minutes, that the economy looks positive. Consumers are feeling positive. In fact, they are the bright light of the economy. They're pushing it forward. They're two-thirds of the economy, and their resilience throughout this 10-year expansion has really driven the economy forward. It's not all rosy, though. I mean, business investment sentiment is downright grouchy compared to consumers, but consumers are strong, and the Fed's minutes are an acknowledgement of that strength in the economy.
Catherine, I said cuts. Obviously, I meant increases on what the Fed has been doing. Where do we go from here, then? Are we just like status quo into the wobbly yonder, as it were?
If by we you mean the Fed?
Well, yeah. We and this economy writ large, because we're going to get to the bigger picture question here in a minute.
Yeah, well, the Fed has suggested that they're going to keep things as they are for now, and we should not anticipate more interest rates unless there is some substantial change to the outlook. For the overall economy, look, like Neil said, there are some mixed numbers here. The business investment numbers have not been good, even though the consumers seem pretty happy and pretty upbeat. So it really depends on a number of risks that are still out there, including relating to the trade war, whether we will finally have resolution on that.
you stole a look at my notes. So we'll get trade war in a minute, but I want to go overseas for a second to Christine Lagarde, the brand new head of the European Central Bank. She gave a speech today in which she said this, Neela, robust growth is no longer an absolute certainty. Yet another item of disconnect between the U.S. and global economy.
I would argue that that's true here as well.
Huh.
When you put all your eggs in the consumer basket, then you are really counting on that consumer. And right now, we see rising risks, and the Fed does too. So we are in a good place, but that doesn't mean that that place is impermeable and can't be changed. And I think you're seeing that more in Europe than you are here. The sentiment is not as good on behalf of the consumer, and they are struggling to maintain growth, though they are matching that with some really accommodative monetary policy and negative interest rates, which we don't have here yet and aren't likely to. But we have a very, very appealing monetary policy from a growth standpoint. So Lagarde is just pointing out some realism behind these numbers. Not everything is rosy right now.
Speaking of not being rosy, Catherine, the phase one deal we're told is coming with China, and then, oh no, maybe it's not. And yes, it's back on. The stock market keeps falling for the head fake. The question is not, is there going to be a deal, right? The question is, does it even matter at this point because we've had so much back and forth?
Well, markets seem to get buoyed every time.
Every time
there is the prospect of a deal, and then they get disappointed when it doesn't actually materialize. And the question is, why haven't investors learned, I guess, at this point? And I don't know what the answer is.
It's only a half an hour program, Catherine. Come on.
I know. Look, if I had the answer to that, I would be a much richer woman. The real question is, even if there is a deal, how significant is it? What does the Chinese government actually concede? And, you know, this phase one, phase two thing suggests that maybe there's not going to be a whole lot in whatever they end up signing in this first go around. But at the very least, it could suggest that the next set of tariffs that are slated for December may be suspended. And even if there isn't actually full resolution to this trade war, at least there wouldn't be more escalation of it, which presumably markets will be happy about.
Okay, I want to give both of you a chance to answer this last question, which means that you both need to be expeditious in your answers. And Neela, you get to go first. The question is not about impeachment, but it's about impeachment-induced uncertainty heading into an election year when there is also, by definition, uncertainty. Is that a problem for you? Are you worried about that?
No, I'm not, because if I look historically, politics have played little role in market moves. Markets have done pretty well almost under every configuration of political arrangement, whether the White House was owned by the Republicans or the Democrats or Congress. So in terms of markets, I'm not that concerned, but I am concerned in terms of gridlock and the economy. That is a risk that we won't get some things done that need to be done in this election year.
Catherine Rampell, quickly, please. Same question.
I have the same concerns that there will be a resulting political dysfunction, maybe another government shutdown, for example. Maybe Trump does something extreme, if not related to the trade war, some other kinds of economic policy that could have fallout next year.
New budget deadline just before Christmas, by the way, for those keeping track. Thanks, you two. Have a nice weekend.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, talk to you next time. Wall Street on this Friday, and all week, really, mostly sideways. Details, numbers, you know the drill. This has been a week of mixed signals for the Chinese telecommunications conglomerate Huawei, which has been in some national security hot water the past several months. On Wednesday, the Commerce Department let some American companies start selling some non-security related stuff to Huawei again. And now Huawei's small footprint in the U.S. wireless market is in some trouble. Today, the Federal Communications Commission voted to stop letting rural phone carriers use federal grant money to buy equipment from Huawei or its Chinese competitor ZTE. There are details yet to come, of course, but as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports, the handwriting does seem to be on the wall for Chinese telecommunications in the United States.
With that, we will call a vote on the item. Commissioner O'Reilly?
Aye.
Commissioner Carr?
Approve.
With a unanimous vote, the FCC imposed what's effectively a ban on Chinese gear in rural networks. Commission Chairman Ajit Pai gave the rationale that Huawei in particular is a surveillance risk.
We know that hidden backdoors to our networks and routers can allow a hostile adversary to inject viruses and other malware, spy on U.S. companies, and more.
It's the latest sanction for Huawei. Already it is barred from U.S. government networks. Huawei and ZTE are assumed to supply some 60 rural networks, including Pine Belt Communications in southern Alabama. John Nettles is president.
It looks to me like they're moving towards a ultimate total prohibition.
He sees the writing on the wall in Washington and already plans to rip out ZTE parts. Nettles says Chinese equipment has been cheap and reliable. Now he's got to replace it.
Will there be enough money there to do it? How long is it going to take? Because the evolution of the network isn't slowing down for this.
This ban joins a host of U.S. sanctions against Chinese companies in telecom, surveillance, facial recognition. It's all driving the two tech powers further apart. Analyst Paul Triolo at the Eurasia Group calls it decoupling.
We're sort of on the slippery slope here of the U.S. trying to wean itself off of Chinese origin equipment, China trying to design out U.S. equipment. It definitely contributes to the decoupling dynamic.
Huawei, in the meantime, is making big deals in the rest of the world. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
We talk about economic mobility on this program every now and then, how easy or hard it is for Americans to move between income brackets. We're going to talk mobility now. Americans just moving, which we're doing less of now than we have in a very long time. Numbers out from the Census Bureau this week show just 9.8% of us moved in the year that ended in March, the lowest rate on record, and about half of what it was 50 years ago. Marketplace's Amy Scott looked into what it means for the economy when the job you want and the place you want to live don't match up.
Americans are getting older, and economist Susan Lund with the McKinsey Global Institute says older people don't move as much.
We also have dual-income households where you have both spouses working, and it makes it more difficult and more of a risk if one person wants to move for a job.
Technology has also made it easier for people to change jobs without moving, but the decline in mobility started decades before Skype or Slack. Claude Fisher teaches sociology at UC Berkeley. He says government programs like unemployment and flood insurance have also played a role.
You can lose your job and hang on for a couple of years. You can be the victim of a flood and rebuild. There's all sorts of ways in which we have made it possible for people to stay put instead of having to move.
And a lot of people want to stay put. Nearly half of those recently surveyed by the New York Fed. 15% wanted to move but couldn't afford to or felt stuck. That's bad news for one roughly $85 billion industry. Scott Michael is head of the American Moving and Storage Association.
We have seen some companies go out of business, and a lot of movers have tried to diversify their business into other lines of work.
Like moving and storing art or even solar panels. Economists say a less mobile workforce means a less dynamic economy. It's also contributed to the shortage in many parts of the country of available homes to move into. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
All right, quick. Are tomatoes a fruit or a vegetable? Ha! Trick question, because while it's used and cooked with as a veggie, it's technically a fruit, a berry, native to South America, commercially produced here starting in the mid-1800s. And now, in this country alone, farmers produce 2.7 billion pounds of fresh tomatoes a year. But if we grow so many of them and spend so much money on them, why do so many of them tastes so bad? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore is on the produce desk today.
Sometimes grocery store tomatoes do not taste great.
It's like eating cardboard.
Jacqueline Cherizi is from Long Island here at this farmer's market.
It's like Instagram food. Looks pretty, has no taste. I'm of a certain age that I remember the days when food had flavor.
What happened to tomato flavor? Well, we happened to it. At his greenhouse at the University of Florida in Gainesville, Harry Klee is collecting pollen from a lush, 6-foot-tall, dark green tomato plant using an electric toothbrush.
And it turns out that it vibrates at exactly the same frequencies as bees' wings.
Klee is a professor of horticultural sciences. He collects pollen to breed better tomatoes. He says tomatoes have been losing flavor for a while because over the generations, humans have been inadvertently stripping out the genes responsible for flavor.
After World War II, the breeders really intensively focused on improving varieties, increasing yield, getting disease resistance. Flavor has been neglected and it's deteriorated dramatically.
Unlike disease resistance, which can be controlled by, say, one gene, flavor is controlled by at least 30. If one or two didn't get passed on to the next generation, it was hard to tell. And until recently, breeders didn't even know what these genes were. So one by one, over generations of tomatoes, flavor-related genes slipped out of the DNA of a lot of varieties. David Wolf is a breeder with Cicada Seeds.
If you're ignoring certain traits, there's a potential that you can lose those traits.
Well, scientists are not ignoring flavor anymore. For 20 years, they've been trying to identify the genes responsible for flavor. They found good ones in wild tomatoes and heirloom varieties, and they've been trying to crossbreed them with modern commercial tomatoes, hoping the flavor genes get passed down.
The real challenge has been to move the flavor back into the modern varieties without destroying any, all of the hard-earned gains that the breeders have made over that last 60 or 70 years.
In Klee's greenhouse, underneath the ventilation fan, we have Exhibit A of why that's been so hard. It's a 6-foot-tall experimental hybrid.
Hugely improved flavor, but the yield is probably about 90% of what that commercial variety is.
So the price of flavor has been that this particular plant doesn't grow as many tomatoes. In other cases, better flavor genes have made tomatoes more susceptible to disease. Luckily, Harry Klee and other researchers have thousands of other hybrids and trials, and Klee says after 20 years of publicly funded research, he's about zeroed in on that perfect combo of flavor and disease resistance and yield.
Things are really changing now.
Seed producers are now trying to breed the flavor genes Klee and others have identified into the tomato seeds they sell. Again, David Wolf at Cicada Seeds.
We're in an exciting time because I think, you know, hopefully in the next year or two, we'll be able to see the introduction of varieties that the people can say, hey, you know, this has better flavor.
A few hours away in Ruskin, Florida, thousands of tomatoes are whizzing along a conveyor belt inspected by humans and boxed up by robots.
We're currently packing tomatoes that were harvested today.
Tony DeMari there, vice president of the DeMari Tomato Company. If you ask him about taste, he says, don't pin all your dreams of better flavor on genetics. The way a tomato is handled on the way to your dinner plate can ruin even a genetic super tomato, especially if it's been refrigerated.
If you've ever had a mealy, mushy tomato, that typically is indication that the tomato has been kept at too cold a temperatures for a prolonged period of time. Cold is the worst enemy of the quality of a tomato.
And just because improved flavor seeds are available doesn't mean improved tomatoes will make it to consumers, especially if they cost significantly more.
We as growers are willing to pay more for seed if it's a measurable benefit that we get a premium, because you can't, you know, spend X amount more for the seed and not get any benefit back.
In other words, it depends on how much tastier tomato seeds cost, how much tastier tomatoes cost, and whether or not consumers buy them. Will we see more boutique, flavor-filled varieties for a little extra, or will tastier tomatoes at regular prices just become the norm? The science behind tasty grocery store tomatoes has just about arrived. The economics of them, TBD. In Gainesville, Florida, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Well, it was pretty disgusting, frankly. I mean, it was undrinkable.
Wine and why some of it is getting better. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 109 points today, more than a third of 1%, 27,875. The NASDAQ found 13 points, a tenth percent, 85.19. The S&P 500 advanced 6 points, two-tenths of 1%, 31.10 there. You might have heard Tesla unveiled its new electric pickup truck with a demo that included hurling a metal ball at shatterproof windows, and then the glass shattered. Tesla rolled down more than 6% today. Ford, which unveiled its new electric Mustang on this very program on Monday, powered up 2% today. Bonds unchanged. Yield on the 10-year T-note stayed right where it was, 1.77%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, it's Molly Wood. So every year, billions of dollars of aid flows to the developing world to try to solve the problem of extreme poverty. But the thing is, we don't necessarily know which solutions are actually making a difference. But people are working on that.
The idea of never leaving a stone unturned, never think that your idea is that great. Always putting it to the most rigorous test of the evidence. That idea has really caught on. So today, it's not just the 3 of us or 10 of us or 20 of us who do that. It's literally hundreds of researchers. People are already beating on our door asking, can we be part of this movement?
This week on Make Me Smart, how Esther Duflo and her colleagues won the Nobel Prize for using randomized controlled trials to find out what actually works when it comes to fighting global poverty. Find us wherever you like to download.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. For the time being, at least, as Neela and Catherine and I were talking about, consumers are the center of the American economic universe. Our spending is what's driving things. A lot goes into why we shop the way we shop, of course. Finances, values, need. Also, though, accessibility. One in four people in the United States is living with some kind of disability, and that can shape the way they buy things. Hence, today's installment of our series, How We Shop.
My name is Nikki Finley, and I live in Tucker, Georgia, which is outside of Atlanta. I fell down a flight of stairs and hurt my neck. It was harder and harder for me to get around. I really have a lot of trouble walking through a mall, for instance, or looking for home decor, that kind of thing. I am dependent on someone else taking me and kind of motoring me around if I need to go. And so that has led to a lot of online shopping. Probably 90 to 95%. But before my neck injury, probably more like 30% of my shopping was online. I have a really different experience than, for instance, my children, who just think, well, this is what I need, so I go find it online. As opposed to, for instance, my father, who's 81 years old, and he wants to go to a store. But for me, it's kind of a combination of the two. I start with a catalog. I look through it. I see if there's something that's kind of nice and what I need or what I want. And then I go from there to their online site. I'm 59 years old, and I just want to see what I'm looking at before I buy it. And since I can't get to a store as easily, the catalogs are the best substitutes. I'm also a big reader. Just shopping through a catalog has been kind of natural to me a long, long time.
That was Nikki Finley there in Tucker, Georgia. Tell us how you shop, would you? Your habits, your tricks, your weaknesses, and your must-haves. You can do that at marketplace.org. We did an interview a couple of weeks ago about how climate change is changing the way wine tastes and how winemaking regions are moving north. Here with an example. English wines were a laughingstock for decades, not so much anymore, though. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports now from Renishaw Hall in the north of England.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, would you like to gather round, please?
A tour guide corrals a group of visitors about to enter a fine old country mansion.
Welcome to Renishaw Hall. It was built in 1625.
Home to the Sitwell family for almost four centuries, Renishaw is packed with historical and artistic treasures. One item that doesn't feature on the tour, though, is the original vintage from the Hall's vineyard.
Well, it was pretty disgusting, frankly. I mean, it was undrinkable.
Alexandra Sitwell, who inherited the estate along with the vineyard from her late father, Sir Rearsby Sitwell.
He used to offload quite a lot of the wine on sort of unsuspecting guests, and I used to spend my life sort of waving behind him, saying, for goodness sake, whatever you do, do not drink it. That's how bad it was.
Sir Rearsby planted his vines in 1972 in this walled paddock not far from the hall. An odd decision, says the man who runs the vineyard today, winemaker Kieran Atkinson.
This was the most northerly vineyard in the world, and when it was planted, most people thought Sir Risby was being extremely eccentric.
Mad would be a better description, wouldn't it?
Well, I think so, but the madness has turned to greatness.
Thanks, he says, to climate change. The long, dreary, overcast summers that Sir Risby had to contend with are gone. Over the last decade, Britain's had its warmest weather on record, and the much maligned Renishaw vineyard is now flourishing.
As you can see, we are teeming with fruit. Lots and lots of gorgeous fruit. The flavours themselves are kind of gooseberry, lime, elderflower, crisp, delicious fruit, perfect for making, I think, what England's becoming famous for, English sparkling wine.
Climate change, he says, has created the same conditions here that once prevailed in the Champagne region of France, more than 400 miles to the south. 10,000 bottles of Renishaw's once derided wines are now sold each year at up to $30 a pop, and they're winning awards.
We've gone head-to-head with Champagnes, and we've beaten them. And this is from here in the north of England, so a long way from
wine country.
Wine country, indeed.
Renishaw is not unique. Last year, English vineyards produced 15.5 million bottles, more than double the previous record of 6.3 million set in 2014. Daniel Woolson is drinks industry editor with the Grocer magazine.
It's a real homegrown success story. You know, it's a story of an industry that's now producing wines that are top quality and can compete with other wines from around the world.
And he says even the sniffiest of sniffy French wine producers have taken notice, particularly since climate change is beginning to make some of their vineyards less productive.
We've actually got big French champagne houses like Tattinger and Champagne Pommery buying land in England where they're going to grow English sparkling. Of course, they can't call it champagne because it's not being grown in Champagne.
This great house stands in a magnificent Italianate garden.
Back at Renishaw Hall, everyone's pleased with the transformation in their vineyard's fortunes. Alexandra Sitwell says Sir Risby would have felt vindicated.
My father would be absolutely delighted. And he'd say, just prove the point that yes, we can grow wine in North East Derbyshire.
And Renishaw's Kieran Atkinson says that within 40 years, climate change could make it hot enough for this vineyard to produce full-bodied red wine.
You know, as a winemaker, that's exciting. As a human, also quite scary.
At Renishaw in the north of England, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today for your Thanksgiving week travel planning. This is going to be, AAA says, the second biggest Thanksgiving driving week since AAA began keeping track. Only 2005 was busier. An extra 1.5 million people will be on the roads this year compared to last. That's almost a 3% increase. But airplanes are going to be worse. 4.5% more people in that long, skinny aluminum tube up in the sky with you. All right, that's it. The Dow Industrial is up 109 today, more than a third of 1%. The NASDAQ gained 13 points, a 10th percent. The S&P 500 advanced 6, that is 0.2%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.